Good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming. We're taking a bit of a break from Tim's study. Of course, he's not here traveling this morning. So what we're going to be talking about this morning is I'd like to have a bit of a discussion on origins, and in particular, the origin of the universe. So just a small, you know, light topic for the next hour and all. And what I'd like to do in particular is to compare thoughts of origin from a couple different perspectives or worldviews. So we're going to talk about from a Christian perspective, and I'm also going to compare that with some of the popular notions of origins of the universe now from a humanist perspective. So I'd like to compare those and see which ones really stand up to reality and good reasoning and all. So we've talked in the past before about how every worldview, every system of thought or perspective of the world really has to answer four questions. Have to answer the questions of origin, of meaning, of morality, and of destiny. So every worldview sets out to answer those questions. Some of them don't answer them very well, or believe they don't have answers, but that's really the challenge for every worldview, to try to answer those. So we're looking at just one of those four, the question of origin. And as I mentioned, a popular notion of origin in our day is the humanist perspective. And two aspects to that. One thought is that things created themselves. They kind of came into being spontaneously, kind of a self-creating notion. And we also hear the language of creation by chance. And so those are two areas that I'm going to dig into a little bit further. Of course, from a Christian perspective, we understand the universe to be created by God, to be created by the Creator. And we see God as infinite, having always existed, and we see God as transcendent, meaning that it's a different order of being from the material world, right? It's something separate from the material world. So those are the two views, and as we walk through those, I'm going to be asking questions about which of these are well-reasoned and well-thought-out. Which of them fit with the laws of logic and good sound reasoning, and which don't? So I want to talk about the laws of logic to set some of the foundation for us. And some of these have fancy words, but it's very simple to understand. We talked about these. There are three laws of logic. Does anybody remember what any of those three are? Bill?
Law of identity.
Okay, that's one. Yep.
Law of non-contradiction.
Law of non-contradiction. Excellent. There's one last one. It's the one that you hear least of, probably the law of excluded middle. And they all fit together. That all sounds fancy and complex. It's really not. And let's take each one of them. We'll break them down. And this is logic that wasn't created by men. It's just part of being within a world that's ordered. And it gives evidence, actually, to a creator that there is order, that we can have order to our thought and we can reason in this way. So let's take the first one, the law of identity. Anybody want to take a shot at what that means? So when I say, this is a table, what do I mean? I mean, this is a table. So whatever is, is. That's all it is. That's all it means. When I say this is a table, I'm saying this is a table. When I use those words, the meaning is not, I think this is a chicken, right? And that sounds very weird in that, why would we even need to talk about that? And you'll find out why we actually do. It's something as simple as that. So when we say table means table, that's the law of identity. John?
So we're saying that law of identity is a communication law.
Right.
So when you say those sounds,
yep,
that you were sure that when those sounds hit my ears and my brain is thinking the same words that you think? Is that all the same?
That's right.
Is that all part of that?
Right.
Okay.
And if you were to be on the receiving end of that after hearing this is a table, and you said, John said that that's a chicken, that would not be well reasoned, right? That statement is false. We could say with certainty, your thought then is false. It's not true. Right? Okay, so that's law of identity. Law of non-contradiction was the second one. So that simply means nothing can be and not be at the same time. Right? So when I say this is a table and it exists, it can't be a table and not be a table at the same time. Right? So that's law of non-contradiction. If I were to say that and somebody said, well, you know, the table doesn't exist when it's really here, he'd violate the law of non-contradiction. And that would be not true. It doesn't align with reality, is what we're saying. The third one, law of excluded middle, is related to those first two. And it just means everything must either be or not be. There is no third way. There is no middle ground. So either this table exists or this table does not exist in the same, at the same time, in the same relationship, right? There's not a third way, a middle ground. It's got to be one of those two. So that's all that those three laws mean. Anybody have questions on that? Does that all make sense? Seems pretty straightforward. Okay, Bill?
Maybe a comment. I think what it assumes is how fallen our thinking is that we've had to clarify those things over and over again.
That's right.
It's such a duh moment, you know?
Right. And it is so basic, and you'll get people to respond. Well, that's why I don't want anything to do with philosophy or of that kind. It's a waste of time. It's that duh moment, right? But it actually does matter. And people break these laws all the time, every day. Very bright people break these laws. Go ahead, John.
It's amazing how few master's level classes you have to take to discover that these are actual things that people... I took one class, one master's level journalism class, and this was all we talked about was how do I know when I type a word that what I say is going to be understood by the reader. How do you know that? And it was very interesting, but you can really get lost in the weeds if you can't answer the questions.
Yep. Yep.
It wasn't master's class, but it was a fine arts class, and it was a class that both the commercial students had to take and the fine arts students had to take. And the fine arts students sat on one side of the auditorium, and it was just de facto segregation. It just happened. And the commercial arts, a plan on making a living, were on the other side. And the fine arts students didn't know they were there.
Didn't know that they existed.
No, they didn't know. They may not even be there. But yeah. The commercial arts students knew that they were there.
Yeah, I have heard that. I have heard that before. As far as some folks will even ask the question, somebody trying to make the case that yes, you do exist, and you can know that for sure. And somebody says, "Well, I don't believe that. How do I know that I even exist?" And the person can respond, "Well, to who shall I give the answer to?" So there's your answer. So yeah, you guys.
I think therefore I am.
Right.
Descartes.
Yep, Descartes. Right. Yep.
But it also explains why, like at IU Bloomington, why the English department is a department which is considered the most godless department on campus. Like, why them? Well, it's because these are the places where these laws can be broken without consequence. In engineering...
Or they think they can.
In engineering, either the bridge is or isn't. I mean, there's no, you know, but you get, you know, business, either the money's there or not.
Yeah.
But here, you can play with these all day long and not feel the consequence of it.
But we're going to see how this has crept into even some of the sciences, too, some of the thinking. So, okay, so there's some of our foundation for reasoning. So keep those in mind as we walk through and compare these two different thoughts about origin. And I'm going to start with the Christian perspective, a biblical perspective, just pulling out just a handful of verses. We can go through many, and we can talk through, again, are any of these laws ever broken in any of this? So let's start from the beginning, Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. So here we see there was a beginning of the universe. It had a starting point. And we see a being, God, outside of that, creating. So far, so good, right? And this is the heavens and the earth. So all of the universe. No violations of logic there. Isaiah 37:16. Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, enthroned between the cherubim, you alone are God over all the kingdoms of the earth. You have made heaven and earth. So again, very clear about the position. Creator, making a separate universe, something different from himself. He's not part of that universe, but creating it. John 1:1-3. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made. And that last part is two different ways of saying the same thing. So through him all things were made, were created. And then the second way of saying that was without him nothing was made that has been made. So basically, there is nothing that exists that came about being without him creating it, right? All inclusive. So we're seeing consistency within Scripture. And I'll give you one more. Colossians 1:16, for in him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities, all things have been created through him and for him. So again, we now see why. So we start answering the question of meaning too as part of that. But through all of those verses, very clear, there's a being God creating all things. So we see God is separate from creation, and he's the first cause of creation and eternal. Yes?
Can I play a devil's advocate?
You can.
Did you deny the law of identity when you said that the Word was with God and the Word was God?
No, I did not. Do you want me to answer that, or do you have any?
Oh, feel free.
Yeah. So, the Word being God, and so there is not a violation because you're saying that, and this is again persons of the Trinity. You're saying they're distinct in persons, but they are not separate in being. They are all one in being. So that's the three in one. And so you go down you have problems if you start separating the persons of the Trinity into separate beings. They are one being, different only in respect to persons in that one being. So you've not violated the law of identity.
James White wrote the book, The Forgotten Trinity, and in there he said something that's very helpful. It's been helpful for me since I read it, and that is, there is one what and three whos.
That's it, right. That would be another way to set, distinctions in persons.
Again,
there is one what and three whos.
So the what is God, and then the persons are the who, yeah. Okay, good question, good challenge. Okay, so let's go on. And speaking of, and I mentioned that God is separate from creation and that he's eternal. He has always been. And we see that in Psalm 90, verse 2. Before the mountains were born, or you brought forth the whole world, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. So, infinite in both directions. There was never a time that God did not exist. eternal. In yes, John.
What was the reference there?
Psalm 90, verse 2. Everlasting to everlasting. Is the thought of there being an eternal being, does that violate reason in any way or logic? Anybody can challenge me if they think it does.
Well, why would it?
That's what I'm asking. I don't think it does. But.
Well, I think it depends on your idea of, like, the laws of thermodynamics and the idea of, is he inside those laws or is he outside those laws? If he's inside those laws, then eternity doesn't work in that context. If he's outside of those laws, if he made those laws, then maybe not.
Right, right. And since we've established that he's outside, he's separate, he's transcended from creation, he's not bound by those laws of thermodynamics.
But since we live in these laws, it's so hard for us to think outside that box that
right.
we live in.
But the notion of an eternal being doesn't violate any of those laws of logic, right? Doesn't violate reason. It's not an irrational thought, actually. Okay. So let's go on. And now let's talk about the humanist faith and thoughts on origin. And I am using the word faith on purpose. This is something that we need to be diligent about in making sure that humanism is understood as a faith. It's not the case that there's the faith of Christianity and others, and somehow humanism sits out here as just simply logic and reason. It's not. It absolutely is a faith. And we can say that because we know that every person is finite. We have limits. We're not all-knowing. We can't be every place at the same time. So we have to assume certain things are true. We have to presuppose certain things too. And the humanist has to do that too. And then they have faith in those first principles, right? That's why humanism is a faith. It's a competing faith with Christianity. Does that make sense, everybody? Because it's important. You don't hear it very often, but it should be mentioned every single time it comes up.
Well, the humanists don't want it mentioned because it challenges their position.
Right.
And it challenges the... It takes away the opportunity to challenge the most dedicated of the humanists in being wrong.
Right.
Because if it's not a faith, then how do they account for errors and incorrect assumptions as far as the humanists are concerned?
Right, right. And I have had discussions with folks where you can bring them to that realization that they are finite, and they can say, I'll accept that I have to have certain assumptions and but I don't like the word faith. I don't like the word religion. I don't like the word faith. I don't want to use that. So I've actually had people tell me that because they've got so much invested in trying to do away with the notions of faith and religion. So they might not want to let it, they might not want to speak of it, but there it is. It's the real deal. So thinking about the universe, all matter, and universe means combined into one or whole. So that's what we're talking about when we talk about universe. Sometimes referred to as cosmos. Does anybody know what cosmos means?
Carl Sagan show.
I'm actually going to talk about the show here in a bit, if we have time.
Order.
Cosmos means order. It's actually a wonderful name for that show. It's a perfect name. A universe of order. And there can be no order without an orderer. So every time I see the title of the show, I'm like, yep, that's right. Over and over again, proclaiming that there's order. So, and the popular notion is that the universe is roughly 13 billion years old, right? That's kind of popular notion. What was that, Nate?
I thought it was 14.
It's, you know, you can hear 13 to 15. So, you know, give a few billion
it's
years.
Like it's like the national debt. A billion here, a billion
yeah.
there. So there's different denominations then?
There are absolutely different denominations within the humanist faith. So, and within the scientific community. That's another kind of misunderstanding, is that all scientists are saying the same thing. They absolutely are not saying the same thing. So anyway, and you can, and one example is, and you could go out and look at a scientific board, a forum board on physics and others, and just ask the question, has matter always existed or not? And you'll get every different kind of opinion you can think of. Yes, it has always existed. No, it couldn't have existed because of the laws of thermodynamics, like John was saying. You'll get many different kinds of opinion. And there's a common thought that all of the universe existed down to a single dense point. It was all collapsed and called the singularity, and it burst forward from there. And that presents all kinds of problems. Well, did the point exist eternally or not? Did it have a beginning or not? But the popular notion is that the universe had a beginning, which means it had to come into existence, right? It had a starting point. Something had to start it if it had a beginning. And that brings us to two areas, thoughts of creation, self-creation, or creation by chance. I want to talk about those two from a humanist perspective. And I've got several quotes here because I want you to hear from astrophysicists, theoretical physicists. I want you to hear their own words. And none of us are physicists here that I know of, right? Nobody has degrees. And I'm guessing you'll be able to pick out problems with these without having a degree at all. You'll do just fine. So let's talk through some of these. I think it was in 2010, Stephen Hawking and Leonard Lotnow, two physicists, theoretical physicists, wrote a book called The Grand Design. And lots of interesting things. I haven't read the full book. I've only seen quotes from it. And I'm going to give you one quote right here. And I want you to remember our rules of logic. And as you hear this, let's talk about if you hear any problems with this statement. So here's the quote from the book. Because there is a law like gravity, the universe can and will create itself from nothing. Spontaneous creation is the reason there is something rather than nothing. Why the universe exists and why we exist. It is not necessary to invoke God to light the blue touch paper and set the universe going. So, let's break this down a little bit. Nate, it sounds like you maybe picked up on an issue in there.
Yeah, I'll just quote Bill Cosby.
Okay.
Okay, Bill Cosby.
Sure.
That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
The dumbest thing. So let's talk about why, would you say it's irrational?
Yes. He's okay. Begging the question.
Okay.
Where does gravity come from?
Right, so Dave's got the first one. Is gravity something or nothing?
It's something.
It's something.
Law. You call right. it a law.
You call it a law. It's something, right? So, you know how we were talking about how the law of identity, that's that dumb moment? It's like, why do we even have to talk about why something is? And here we have one of the greatest minds, probably the most popular scientists currently in the world, saying gravity is nothing, right? That's not a true statement. So already at this point, we can say this isn't just one opinion that somebody has that could be true. We're saying there is not a possibility that this could ever be true, right? Does everybody get that? Okay. So, let's see if there's anything else. Let's talk about, he mentions the universe can and will create itself from nothing. Let's talk about that. So, there is nothing, and then something creates itself.
You began with a negation.
It began with a negation, right? Mm. So anytime somebody mentions self-creation, you violate that law of non-contradiction. Because in order for something to create itself, it has to be before it is. Something has to be if it's going to create. And so, again, is the notion of self-creation ever possible?
No.
No, not ever. So it's not that it's just one opinion that may or may not be true, and maybe we haven't discovered. It's not possible ever in reality, right? Yeah.
And I was just telling Bill, I said, the problem with that is you fall into what's called infinite regress.
Yep.
Where you just keep going back and going back. There's no real starting point.
Right. And Bertrand Russell fell into that same. He had the idea of causation going back infinitely, right? He was saying, well, God also had to have a first cause.
He had a number of problems, but that was one of them.
And so, and he would just go back, and he was, it's just taking one step back further. You never escape the problem of self-creation. So does that make sense? We're kind of, it's kind of complicated stuff, but when you break it down, it actually is pretty simple. Something can't create itself, right? Okay. So that simple statement right there violates the laws of logic right out of the gate.
How can they be believing things that are so obviously that just don't make any sense? They're so intelligent. I mean, it's so obvious.
This is, and that's a great question. So there are clearly blind spots, right? Brilliant men. I mean, these are some of the most brilliant minds in the world, and they go to sleep in certain places.
I don't think that doesn't conform with what Scripture says. They are at war against God. They refuse to see what He has created and what He has done.
Yeah.
It's not that they have blind spots, it's that they're fighting against God.
It's a purposeful blindness.
Yes, yeah.
It is a blind spot because of their lie, rebellion.
It's a refusal to accept God's law and His word. And they justify that refusal by putting out all sorts of turmoil. And the infinite regression takes the average person back 10 steps and gets acceptance through those 10, but it takes them back 20 and 30 and 150.
Right.
And it's the confusion that they generate. I would contest that they're great minds. They may be very intelligent.
That's that's what I mean. I'm not trying to let any of them off the hook by saying they are very bright. They're a blind spot. They are absolutely accountable, and I hope to touch on that too. But it is like there are these selective windows where it doesn't fit. It's they step into irrationality, step into the absurd. So Nate first, then Bill.
I was just going to say that in my experience that having a very high IQ and being regarded as highly intelligent by the world often works against sinners.
Yeah.
And they come to trust in their own competence as they understand it to be. And
there's the issue of pride.
The issue of pride, right? And that becomes a blinder to Christ so that they can't see the forest for the trees. And they do that simply by appealing to their own level of intelligence.
Right.
And those who, their sycophants who follow them, will appeal to their intelligence. How could you possibly disagree with Stephen Hawking?
Right.
Is your IQ as high as his is? Do you have the degrees he has? And blah, blah, blah.
Right. And you will actually find that. I mean, I've been challenged probably within the last month by somebody who wanted to make sure to let me know they had a degree in physics. To make sure they put me in my place so they understand, I'm going to let me school you now on...
And I know.
Right.
The laws of logic sometimes don't apply.
Yeah, right. So absolutely. And we're going to look, if there's time here, we'll look at why there actually is no excuse for these blind spots. And actually, to some degree, they're seeing a degree of design within the world that they're actually, there's a level of account that is greater the more that you see
willful denial
and carrying the baggage of atheism, the emotional baggage of atheism into the equation is a big deal. It's, I will not have a God, and so I'll find every formula I can possibly find.
Well, look at how they titled their book, The Grand Design.
Right.
It wasn't the grand oops.
Or it wasn't just symbols written. Yeah, that's right. That's right. They can't ever escape it. So let's look at some other stuff here. Here's another quote from the book. The Grand Design. Traditionally, there are questions for philosophy, but philosophy is dead. Philosophy has not kept up with modern developments in science, particularly physics. Scientists have become the bearers of the torch of discovery in our quest for knowledge. So physics is dead. So let me ask you a question.
You mean
what kind of
philosophy is dead?
Philosophy is dead. So what kind of a statement is philosophy is dead? Is that a scientific statement? It's a philosophical statement that philosophy is dead. So again, you don't need a degree in physics to point out the obvious on this stuff. And that's why we should be very comfortable in engaging on these discussions every chance we get. We don't have to kind of sit in the shadows because we don't have a degree in physics. We've had great minds that have come before these men who were well balanced across the disciplines. And if something is true, it's true in philosophy, it's true in science, it's true in physics and across the board, and men were more balanced in that way. Bill.
Well, I think it was interesting, I think it was Nietzsche, at least in the philosophical field, that first said that God is dead, and we began with the Great Negation anyway, with the infinite regress.
Yeah.
And now everything's being reduced to science and, of course, the empirical field of knowledge, which you can see, taste, touch, hear, so on.
Right.
And eventually we'll just consume ourselves.
Right. Well, and I think you see that degree of specialization in these areas, and they're not well balanced. They're actually oftentimes really bad at logic, which is a horrible thing for science. Or they're bad at philosophy, or they're bad at linguistics, and their language is really sloppy. And that's a problem. And so, Nate, you were going to say something.
I was just going to say that it's a natural progression for going, Bill made me think of this, to go from Nietzsche's statement, God is dead, to Hawking saying that philosophy is dead. Because apart from God, you cannot have philosophy. You can't have the laws of thought, the laws of logic. The mind becomes nothing but an illusion at that point. And so you might as well say knowledge is dead at that point, because once you lose philosophy, you lose the entire apparatus of but you lose the ability to even define what knowledge is.
That's right. Right. Point. And so, yeah, if you go there, not only is philosophy dead, like you said, knowledge is dead, science is dead. So what does philosophy mean?
The love of knowledge.
The love of knowledge, or the love of wisdom. So they're saying that's dead. So there's a point there where I can say, if you go where you're going, you're right. You don't love wisdom, there is no wisdom there. So, Mark,
read. Well, I was just going to say, to me, what they're doing then is they're moving science from around that's subservient to what it should be to higher things like philosophy. They're moving it into the realm of religion.
That's right.
Where then it can take its, independent place in a sense. It's not relying upon those other things because it's elevated above what it is.
And it destroys it, though, in the process. When you do that to science, you end up destroying true science.
That's right.
When you try to make it a religion, that is destroying
faith of humanness.
Right. Yep. So, and you get these logical outworkings of that belief. Yeah, John.
First of all, you give me a great idea for a defense, because people say, I have a degree in physics. Well, I have a degree in journalism, and you're using words. And so that's my field. If you want to draw numbers on a board, then you have that. If you're using words, and I know how you're using words, because I know how to bamboozle with words. But the other thing is that the end, that metaphor at the end of that first book you had about touching, God touching a match to the
paper. Oh yeah, the blue touch paper and setting the universe going.
Note their use of metaphor.
Right.
Okay. And guess how poor of a job he does, because he's using it exactly backward.
Right.
Because it's not a matter of a match touching the paper. It's a matter of fire undoing itself and becoming paper on its own. Mm-hmm. He's using a metaphor exactly the opposite, and right. He's proving exactly the wrong point with it.
Right.
And that's an old ploy, by the way, using the wrong metaphor to make your point. And he probably thinks he's kind of clever for doing that.
And that's why it's good that all these disciplines, like I said, if it's true in one area, it's true for all the other disciplines. And there is a healthy back and forth to balance folks out like that.
And so. It's very convenient to say philosophy is dead, so that way you shut up an entire discipline from correcting you when you do something stupid. Yeah, right. That building over there, that philosophy building, those guys might have some good questions. The freshmen in that building might have some good questions for you.
That's right. Right then. They would point some of this
but
stuff out.
But our modern philosophy is dead.
Well, yes. Well, they would at least ask, they wouldn't have any answers, but at least they'd have a bunch of questions. You know, I'd say for a guy first level freshman, but have some questions like, well, how do you know you even exist? You know, dum-dum 101 kind of questions from a philosophy department would tear apart that kind of book.
Right, right.
If he would walk across the quad and talk to them.
Right.
Yeah, but the philosophers are in cahoots with these other guys. They're just as atheistic, and so they're the postmoderns are living under the same mantra, never question authority.
But I think you have different camps in each space. You have good scientists. Mm-hmm. You have very good physicists. You have good philosophers, and you have really bad philosophers. And it's all an outworking of that faith and which path they're on. And so, and they're all going to have
so
an outcome.
Christian scientists and Christian philosophers and then everybody else is what you're saying, right? Because you can't really be consistent and be a good philosopher without Christ.
That's right. That's one of the points we're making here. Which way is consistent with the real world and which way is not?
Against itself.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Let me give you a couple other quick quotes, because again, I want you to hear in their own words and how easy it is to spot some of this stuff. Here's another one from Lawrence Krauss. He wrote, "A Universe from Nothing, Why There Is Something Rather Than Nothing." And this little quote here is from a chapter called Nothing Is Something. So already not off to the greatest of start on the chapter title there. So here's his quote. "By nothing, I do not mean nothing, but rather nothing, in this case, the nothingness we normally call empty space. It can be truly said that we're all here today because of quantum fluctuations in what is essentially nothing."
It's so deep, man.
It's really not, and this is how it happens. So,
yeah,
sounds really profound to somebody that's not paying attention at the most basic thing here. So, nothing is something. Is that a true statement?
Another idea brought to us by marijuana. Or something worse.
Well, I think he's essentially attacking language there at some point where he's redefining nothing right away in his sentence. He's trying to redefine nothing. Well, nothing as in stuff that's not there.
Right.
You know, what do you
mean? So do I treat that statement right. as something or nothing?
Exactly.
So I... Right. So,
I thought he was defining nothing actually as something, because he said it's not nothing; it's just space.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So then you don't have.
And then he talks about there being fluctuations in nothing.
Yeah.
What does it take to have a fluctuation in something?
Something to be
something.
There.
Right. So again, this statement. Again, this is non-science. Right, this is junk science. It's bad linguistically. It's irrational. It's absurd. It's like a flight from reason. And so that's why it's really easy to point these things out. Bill?
I think it was Mary asked earlier, and I think it's a good question. Why is it that people, you know, this is so obviously arbitrary and ridiculous. Why is it that people buy into this? Why do these
it's,
buy
if you're trying to escape your guilt,
right?
and you're looking for anything to hang your hat onto, mm-hmm. to try to make a world without a God that you're going to be accountable to, you will buy into anything, yeah. even when it's totally irrational.
Well, I was thinking too that it's not their ability at these philosophical or religious points to describe things. They are ingenious in some of their empirical descriptions.
Yeah, thankfully they're not consistent right. in their irrationality.
And that's where we need to embrace their humanity and thank God for it, because we can use that as a touchstone.
Absolutely.
And say, look, you're thinking correctly here, and the reason is because God hasn't completely given you over to foolishness.
Right. Right.
And you're making sense here.
Right. They bear the image of God, which mm-hmm. holds intact enough reason and rationality for them to even function and for them to do some science. Right.
In addition to, of course, giving them license to sin because it doesn't exist, it's the emperor's new clothes amongst the intellectuals. Mm-hmm. They don't want to be humiliated by their peers, and the ones who are students want in to the circle, and if they're looking for tenure somewhere or acceptance in a group,
oh, absolutely.
They're not getting in.
That's right.
Unless they are bowing at the right altar.
Right.
And even if they, all those questions come to their mind, they will never voice them.
That's right. The pressure is incredible, right? And it could be their livelihoods. And it is in sometimes decisions on whether or not I'm going to make a living in these institutions or not. Do I toe the line or do I not? And kind of thinking of that, I'm going to pull out one quote that I have that speaks just to that. Nate mentioned the show Cosmos, used to be hosted by Carl Sagan, astrophysicist. Now it's hosted by Neil deGrasse Tyson. You may be seeing the show as it exists right now. Here's a quote from him. Seems like a nice guy, right? Put him in the right setting, and you'll, if you're on the receiving end of a different belief, you might think differently. But here's a quote from him. God is an ever-receding pocket of scientific ignorance. I want to put on the table not why 85% of the members of the National Academy of Sciences reject God. I want to know why 15% of the National Academy don't. That's the kind of pressure. And this is one of the most famous astrophysicists currently today. So you want to talk about pressure for these guys. The last thing I want to touch on before we close, I talked about self-creation. I want to talk about just the language of something being created by chance. Okay, when somebody says that, is that a true statement or not? And they do say it. I'm kind of skipping through a few things here. I'm going to give you a quote from Peter Atkins. He's a former professor of chemistry at Oxford. He wrote Creation Revisited. And pick out what he says about chance in this. Now we go back in time beyond the moment of creation to when there was no time, to where there was no space. From this nothing, there came space-time. And with space-time, there came things. And then in a later chapter, in the beginning, there was nothing. The universe was without form and void. Here's the key point. By chance, there was a fluctuation and a set of points, like, right, emerging from nothing and taking their existence from the pattern they formed, defined a time. Okay, so you see the notion of self-creation kind of buried in there too, which we already dismantled. That's not possible. But when he says, by chance, there was a fluctuation and set of points, just, again, it's nonsensical language.
So convenient.
Sometimes it's almost like just by saying something makes it true, right?
That's the chance. We understand that the universe was created by the word of scientists.
Right. Yeah. So, but when somebody says that it was created by chance, what is chance?
It's nothing.
Chance is not a thing, right? We can talk about mathematical probabilities. That's a good use of chance. If I flip a coin, it's the chance that this is heads or tails, that's good. But if I flip a coin and I say, what effect did chance have on the outcome? Did it have any effect? No, chance doesn't do anything. It's not a thing.
Chance is only what you can see from the future looking back, and you can't
probability. You can run probabilities.
Yeah, probability of it.
But chance is nothing. So when somebody says something is created by chance, they're saying something is created by nothing.
Right.
And now we're back to self-creation. We already said that's not possible. Nate.
And even if we define chance as probability, probability does not entail unless something actually exists.
Right. It's not a chance is not a force.
Right. You can't measure the probability of a coin flip unless you have a point.
Right.
Yeah, but you can go farther than that. So chance is really our fudge factor because we don't understand it clear enough to actually calculate it.
Okay,
so
that's right.
If you knew everything, you could calculate it, and then chance as an idea would be gone.
That's okay. Right.
But it's easier for us to talk about chance just because we don't understand the details about how it works.
So room for error.
Yes.
Okay. Let's get to communicate in a degree of ignorance.
Right.
I think.
But it doesn't. The point is, anytime somebody
that's
says
that's a scientific definition of chance, by the way.
Yeah. But the point I want to make is anytime somebody says that it was the universe or anything was created by chance, we can say, that's not true. You're violating rules of logic here, Bill.
I think though, the way they use it, chance is the apostate version, the apostate concept of providence. Because that's how they're using it, because it is just that filler.
Right.
You know what I mean? Because when we can't explain something, we know that God and His intelligence and wisdom and so on and so forth have providentially set forward and is governing creation according to His own wisdom and so on.
Yeah.
So the way in which they do it is they just have to appeal to this.
Yeah.
What they say is immobile or whatever, but it has a mobility to it.
Right. Well, the other thing going on here is replacing meaning for chance. So you can say a chance in these mathematical probabilities, that's good, but I'm going to use it in a different way, in a different time.
Right.
That's a fallacy. So we are out of time here. I'm going to give you one quote and then scripture. I've got to get this quote in from a Danish physicist, Niels Bohr. You may have heard the name. Very popular. Nobel Prize winner in physics. And this is one of his founding principles. He actually had this saying in Latin on his as a coat of arms. And his saying was, a great truth is a truth of which the contrary is also a truth. So, yeah, we laugh at that. Think about how not only meaningless this is, think about how dangerous this is. So if thou shalt not kill is a truth, thou shalt kill as a command is a great truth too. So again, words have meaning, and these are men in position of modifying thought. Nick,
not only are they men in position, but they're also state-funded in many cases. And they provide the official worldview of our entire culture.
Right.
Right. And if we measure that according to what gets money from the government.
Yeah.
So does he have a crest saying the opposite on the other lapel, maybe, that says
well,
proof is false?
Yeah, think about that. If that statement he believes is true, then of course the contrary of that statement must be. I'm going to leave you with Romans 1:20. That's right. So I'm going to leave you with Romans 1:20. We talked about this. All men are without excuse. So for since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, His eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that people are without excuse. Okay, it is all there. So engage in the conversations, and thank you.